I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Emotions can be tough to define precisely, and romantic love might be the hardest of all to explain and to understand. But if we don't know what love is, then how can we realize its full potential? Today, we look at the many perspectives of this emotion and our responsibility to fathom exactly what love is. Then we turn to a mother's love and a mother's grief. Sue Klebold lost a child to suicide when her son Dylan entered Columbine High School with a friend and took his own life after killing 13 and injuring 20. Sue will share the complicated story of a mother and son. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Romantics love it, unprepared partners dread it, and some single folks seem to love to hate it. Valentine's Day is a week from tomorrow, and it got us wondering about the nature of love. For Carrie Jenkins, Valentine's Day is a great time of the year. She's a Canada Research Chair and Professor of Philosophy at the University of British Columbia, and she thinks about and researches love all year round. She's here today to give us some perspective on the nature of romantic love. Carrie joins us from the studios of UBC in Vancouver, Canada. And Carrie, welcome. Nice to have you.
Hi there. Good morning.
Well, this time of year, everyone's got romance and love on their minds. It's something you've devoted your career to. It must feel a little like Christmas to you, Carrie.
It's my busiest time of the year these days. And, you know, it's wonderful for me because I want to talk about love all the time. And this time of year, everybody wants to talk with me about it. I love it.
Well, it must seem like a pretty straightforward answer, but just so we're crystal clear here, what is romantic love as opposed to the kind of love between, say, a father and his kids?
Oh, if only it was a straightforward answer. This is actually a really tricky question. And so what I'm trying to do, I've just written a book about this, trying to get at exactly this kind of question. What is the nature of romantic love distinctively that makes it different from all the other kinds of love that you might encounter? And so part of what I'm trying to say is that we have a certain social expectation for romantic love. And by that, I mean, if you fall in romantic love with someone, you expect to be, you know, with them forever. You might be expected to be monogamous with that person, and you might be expected to settle down, maybe live together, maybe even have kids, maybe get married. And we don't expect that of any other kind of love. So, you know, if you really love your friend, you're not expected to move in or have their children, right? That's just a close friendship. And similarly with, you know, familial love, we don't expect any of those kinds of things. So I think a lot of the difference has to do with how we think about what's normative, what's normally expected for romantic love.
No, you also.
But the other.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The other side of it, I think, is that there might be some differences biologically as well. And so I'm trying to get this sort of dualistic nature of love on the table, whereby it's partly social, part culture, and part biological, part nature.
You also write about something you call the romantic mystique. So let's go there. What is the romantic mystique?
This is what's happening when people tell you to stop overthinking it. And when they tell you love is mysterious and incomprehensible and you could never know what it really is. And, you know, trying to understand it is like trying to unweave the rainbow or something like that. I think that's really dangerous because love, I sometimes say love is an extreme sport and we don't skydive without parachutes, right? So we don't just launch ourselves into dangerous situations without trying to understand what they are. And yet, when it comes to falling in love, we're actually positively encouraged to launch ourselves without really understanding what it is. And so part of what I'm trying to do is push back on the romantic mystique and say, no, that's a risky thing. We want to have more understanding. You know, I want to understand the biology. I want to understand the culture around this ideal. And I think that really helps us.
You also say the romantic mystique needs to be resolved. And you mean what by that?
I mean that we need to understand love. So we need to stop saying that it's impossible to get any grasp of what it is, because I think that's a mistake. I mean, we're not going to get any sort of tidy, simple answer. You're not going to get a neat little theory with a heart-shaped bow on top. That's not realistic. But we can understand, you know, there is really good biological research. There's really good psychological research. And there's really good humanities research on the social aspects and the cultural aspects. And how those things come together is really what I'm interested in as a philosopher. And I think we can get a big picture understanding of what's going on here. Well, we should stop pretending it's impossible.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, these notions of biological and social aspects of love. You wrote a book that attempts to demystify love. It's called appropriately What Love Is and What It Could Be. And in it, you say there are two ways of thinking about love, biological and social. Tell us about each of those.
So the biological side is the brain chemistry that's going off when you fall in love, and in some people is still going off 20 years later. And this is about, you know, something that has evolved in us as a species, something that we're biologically hardwired, as it were, to do. And it involves things that you can understand by being a scientist. You know, we can do fMRI scans and look at people's brains when they're passionately in love, and we can see differences from the brains of people who are not in love. That's not to say you can necessarily tell just by looking at someone's brain whether they're in love, but there's a statistical correlation. Huh. So there is something going on biologically. But that's not the only thing that's happening, because something else that's happening is that we're getting all these social messages about what we're supposed to do with that experience that's going on in our bodies and in our brains. And those messages might include things like you're supposed to find the one, you're supposed to settle down, you're supposed to maybe be straight rather than queer, you're supposed to be monogamous rather than polyamorous. We get all of those kinds of messages, and those I don't think necessarily come from the biology. And so what's really interesting to me is trying to separate out where the different aspects are coming from. And to do that, you have to appreciate that there's some on each side.
Why are you so interested in love? What brought that about for you?
Well, it was a combination of my professional life and my personal life. So professionally, I've always been interested in metaphysics, which is the study of reality. So I'm very curious about what's real and what's not, what's natural and what's not, what's projected onto the world by us and what's really out there. That's always been my line of work. And recently, I started to get very interested in love, specifically because I started to come out as being polyamorous myself, which means, non-monogamous. I mean, I'm actually in two relationships. Hmm. And one thing that would happen to me is people would say, oh, that's not real love then. That doesn't count if you love two people, because if you really were in love, you would only have eyes for one person. You would never think about other people. So that kind of message was really noticeable to me, and it got me thinking about this question. So then what is it that they're talking about? What is this thing they're talking about that if you did it with two people wouldn't count anymore? Mm-hmm. And so that ultimately led me to try to bring some of the critical thinking skills that I learned in these other areas for understanding what's real, what isn't, what's natural, what isn't, and try to apply that to love.
Yeah, I think in some more conservative parts of our country, some of these changes you're suggesting are obviously going to be controversial, being in love with one person, more than one person at a time, mm-hmm. for instance, and also this idea that the two people who are in love have to be a man and a woman. That idea, I think, is evolving and changing before our eyes and has been for a number of years. But the notion of being in love with more than one person at a time, that's going to catch people, I think, Carrie.
Yes, and I mean, this is partly why I think it's a very interesting time to have this conversation, because we can see the social norms changing right before our eyes. And in the generation before now, I think people were seeing a similar shift with the greater acceptance of interracial love and relationships. We're seeing greater acceptance of same-sex love and relationships, and now marriage. But what we don't yet see, at least I don't see a lot of representation of non-monogamous love. And I think that that's a conversation that is still needed. But you're right, it absolutely does. I'm not sure it'll catch people by surprise, but it certainly gets people reactions going, and I get a lot of comments and feedback that make it very clear that this is still not something that's widely acceptable.
We're talking about love as Valentine's Day approaches with Carrie Jenkins. She's the author of the book What Love Is and What It Could Be. How about this notion that love is hardwired into the brain, Carrie? That seems kind of an idea that's hard to resist. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I agree. I agree, but I think it's only part of the story.
Meaning?
So I think that, so if you go and look at someone like Helen Fisher, she's a biological anthropologist, and she's also an advisor to Match.com, the online dating service. And she has a theory that says love is entirely biological. She actually thinks it's a fundamental human drive, like hunger and thirst. And she says that it evolved in our species in order to keep a man and a woman together long enough to raise a child through infancy. And so she's thinking of, you know, our hominid ancestors. She thinks the females would have had to carry, when they started to walk on two legs, they would have had to carry babies in their arms instead of being able to put them on their back. And she says that creates a problem then, because they can't forage or hunt or whatever as effectively. So they rely then on a male provider to be able to survive. And so she theorizes that romantic love evolves at that point in our evolutionary history to enable a man and a woman to stay together as the parents of a child. So this is, I mean, it sounds like a very appealing and very natural theory. But in the book, I try to raise some questions about it, because I think there could be some interference in the biology here from the social side of things.
You point out that romantic love varies across cultures and across mm-hmm. eras. And I was going to ask you about that, because if love is hardwired into the brain, how can it be different for different people at different times?
Exactly, right? So not everything can be hardwired. Only some of it must be in the brain. And then the rest of it's being contributed by society. Sometimes I think of it as like an actor playing a role. So you've got the biology in you, and that's your actor. And then you give it a script for what you're supposed to do with that. And sometimes that script changes. So, you know, over time and across different places, you get handed a different script. But yet the same biology in us is still expected to play that script, play that role. So sometimes you get a good fit, sometimes you get a bad fit.
If our listeners have any questions here about love, maybe love in their lives might be appropriate. 816-235-2888 is the number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, your theory is that love is part of a group of biological machinery that evolved to promote cooperation. Biological machinery, is that a fancy way of saying chemicals released into the brain or what, Carrie?
Yeah, I mean, well, it could be the chemicals that are released, or you could think of it in slightly broader terms as whatever it is that's built in to give us the predisposition to release those chemicals. Maybe it's a drive, like Fisher says. But basically, yes, it's all about the brain chemistry, and not just in the brain. You know, there are other changes in the rest of your body too. You might notice your heart beating faster, you know, that feeling of adrenaline that sort of goes, it can be everywhere. You can feel that in your fingertips and your toes as well. So I don't want to just look at the brain, but I think obviously the brain has a lot to do with it. And so the biological side of love is really important, because it kind of points us back into the evolutionary history of this situation. But one of the things that I think is too limiting about just looking at the man-woman monogamous couple that's so familiar to us socially, one of the things that misses is the fact that if you broaden out your perspective historically and culturally, there are so many other models for love and for child rearing. And so this is why I say the biology is probably more geared towards cooperation than towards specifically the nuclear family structure that's familiar to us.
Well, tell us how romantic love varies across cultures. Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. Yes. One of the examples that I like to think about is imagine Victorian England, and imagine a woman falling in love in Victorian England. So she is supposed to she's supposed to find a man, not a woman, and just one, obviously. And then she's supposed to feel a kind of rather distant admiration and respect for this man. It's not really supposed to be a sexual feeling, right? If you had sexual feelings for a man, that wouldn't so much be love as maybe something more like a distraction from love.
Huh. Well, that's interesting, because I notice there's nothing in your theory about reproduction or even sex, and I'm wondering why. Are you there, Carrie? Hey, Carrie, you there? Well, we may have just lost Carrie Jenkins again. She was joining us from the studios of UBC up in Vancouver, Canada. Carrie, you there? Well, I think we've lost her. Okay, well, we're going to try and regain her. Something's happened to our connection. Carrie.
Oh, hi there. Yeah, I'm not sure what happened there.
I'm not sure what happened. Yeah. I asked you a question about sex, and suddenly the line went dead. So I was wondering if there was a connection between the two. I'm glad to hear there's not. Yeah.
Not as far as I know.
Yes. Why isn't there something in your theory about reproduction or sex?
Oh, there is. So I mean, one of the things that social cooperation helps us do is raise children. So, you know, it's really hard raising kids. So cooperation is really important for that. And I think that the biology of love is part of a whole suite of biological mechanisms that we have evolved in order to be able to cooperate in tasks like raising children, but also in a lot of other socially cooperative tasks as well.
You know, one other thing you say we should do away with is this idea that, you know, if you're not married, then you must be lonely. What's so bad about suggesting that people who are alone are not experiencing romantic love?
So what's so bad about suggesting that you can't experience romantic love on your own?
Yeah, I guess people who are alone are not experiencing romantic love. What's so bad about that?
Oh, I don't think there's anything wrong with being alone. I mean, there's something wrong with being sad, maybe, if you don't like being alone. But I think there are a lot of single people who prefer to be single. And so one of the things that I talk about in the book is this kind of pressure to be in a relationship, to be in love, which I think can be harmful to the people who don't want that, people who are very satisfied and very fulfilled by a life that that doesn't have a romantic relationship in it, and they're not looking for that. This is one of the reasons why Valentine's Day, I think, can be really hard for some people.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Wayne from Harrisonville. Wayne, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. This polyamorous deal is something I've sort of given considerable thought to, and I have five children, and my thought about it is that you love all of your children equally. You just love them in a different way, and I think that it's theoretically possible to love more than one person in a romantic sort of way. The only sort of problem I see is because of our cultural situations is that jealousy seems to enter into those situations.
Yeah, I was going to say, Carrie, that idea mm-hmm. does seem so problematic to me, trying to juggle more than one at a time. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, can you do it? Maybe
well,
you
I've
are,
been,
and I'm talking.
I've been doing it for some years now, and yes, a lot of people who I know are in successful polyamorous relationships, so it's not impossible. I mean, different things are possible for different people, so, you know, it depends a lot on who you are and who you're with. Jealousy is a problem that a lot of people struggle with. But then again, it's also a problem in monogamous relationships too. So, you know, this is a complicated one. And certainly my life is not, a one long round of struggles with jealousy. I have a pretty healthy relationship with jealousy these days.
Yeah. If we continue to mess around with the definition of love, you know, what it is, what it isn't, don't we wind up running the risk of sort of destroying it?
So I talk about this a little bit too. I've thought about that question. And, I don't think so, because I think we are actually, you know, we do have that biological anchor that's underpinning where we're going to be prepared to go with love socially. So I think there are some limits to how far we can go. But ultimately, I'm not sure that as long as there's still love, which, you know, could come in many different varieties and many different forms, I'm not so sure that there's anything particularly special about the one form that we happen to call romantic. So if we end up just broadening out love so that, you know, there are lots and lots of different kinds and we don't make one of them special and privilege it over all the others, I'm actually not too worried about that.
Carrie Jenkins, again, is a Canada Research Chair and Professor of Philosophy at the University of British Columbia. Her book, What Love Is and What It Could Be. And Carrie, thanks for the primer here a week or so before Valentine's Day. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Time for a break here. When we come back, we're going to switch topics dramatically. We'll be joined by Sue Klebold, whose son was one of the shooters at Columbine back in 1999. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday, we visited with That 70s Show's Deborah Jo Rupp. Also, we had a crash course on betting on the Super Bowl. You can find those conversations online at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, from reskilling workers to retooling the urban landscape, we'll feature discussions about getting Kansas City ready for the future. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, you can call it grief, you can call it shame, you can call what Sue Klebold has lived with for the past 17 years all that and a whole lot more. One day in April 1999, Klebold's son and Eric Harris walked into Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, and opened fire. We all know what was left behind, 13 bodies and another 24 injured following a rampage that stunned the world. In her book, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy, Sue Klebold tells how she wrestled with all the questions that followed those moments. Questions about why she didn't know what her son Dylan was planning, why she couldn't read her son better, why she didn't know he had been stockpiling weapons. Sue, it's nice to have you here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Steve.
Tell us about the morning of April 20th, 1999, Sue, and the moment your son, Dylan, went out the door early that morning. Something happened that caught your ear that you've been thinking about ever since.
Yes, I was getting ready for work. It was very dark. I used to get up early to get to my job. And Dylan had to get up early also to get to a bowling class that morning. And I noticed in the dark, earlier than he should have been up, I heard him rushing down the stairs, and he was going very quickly. And I leaned out my bedroom door, and it was dark. He hadn't turned on the lights. And I yelled his voice. I said, "Dill?" And at that moment, I heard the front door open, and he yelled, "Bye," and then he slammed the door. And I was alarmed. I thought, what is he doing up so early? Why didn't he talk to me? Usually, you know, we coordinate our plans. It was all very odd. And my take at that moment was something is wrong. I had no idea that it was something lethal or life-threatening or dangerous, but I woke my husband, and my husband had said over the weekend, "Dylan seems off, kind of tense to me. His voice is a little high. Did you notice it?" And I said, "No, I didn't." The weekend before he died, he was going to a prom. He was busy with friends. They were talking about their future. I thought it had something to do with that. But that morning, I really sensed something was bothering him. And I said to my husband worked out of our home, "Will you be home this afternoon so you can talk to Dylan and find out what's bugging him?" And he said, "Yes, I'll do that." And I just sort of left it in his capable hands, saying, you know, whatever would be bothering Dylan, they'd talk about it, and it would be okay. And I went on to work. And that's how that morning started.
You know, fast forward that day to a little after noon. You were in your office when you noticed the message light flashing on your desk phone. Walk us through the next little while there, Sue.
Yes, I was getting ready to go to a meeting at a community college campus, and you know how it is when you get ready for a meeting, you're getting organized, and I was away from my desk. I came back for a moment, and the message light was flashing, and I listened to the message, and it was my husband. He sounded like I'd never heard him before. He was gasping. His voice was ragged. He could hardly breathe. And he said, "Susan, call me back immediately. This is an emergency." And I knew that instant from the tone in his voice that something had happened to one of our children, because nothing could make anyone sound like that unless it had that degree of seriousness. And I called him back, and he didn't even say hello. He just said, "Listen to the television." And he held the phone in front of the television, but of course I couldn't understand what was being said. All I heard was just nothing. And I kept sort of yelling, you know, for him to come back and tell me what was happening. My initial thought, since it was something on television, was that our country was at war, attacked somehow. But then he came back on the telephone and just started blurting out, "There's a shooting at the school. People in trench coats are hurting people. Dylan's best friend, Nate, called us, wondered where Dylan was." And it was just this outpouring of all these things that he was putting together. And I said, "I'm coming home right now." And I hung up the phone and began the drive home.
And it's like a 26-mile trip for you to get home, right?
Yes, it was. We lived in sort of a rural area outside the city. And yes, it was a 26-mile drive.
And at that point then, Sue, you didn't have any feeling that your son was involved as a perpetrator in this thing. You just were concerned that something horrible was going on at the school and Dylan might be hurt.
Right. And actually, what I was afraid, I had all kinds of fears. I mean, you can imagine, I was at one moment thinking Dylan had been arrested. He and Eric had stolen something.
Eric Harris, who was his co-conspirator in the shootings,
yes,
that day, right?
Correct. They had been arrested more than a year earlier, 14 months earlier, and they had gone through a diversion program together. And part of that program said that if they were involved in any kind of trouble at all, that they would have, this would be a criminal record for them. So my thoughts were, there's been a prank, there's been a misunderstanding. I believe that it was very likely that Dylan was involved in something, but it didn't connect with me that he could actually be hurting people or shooting people or have a gun. Those things hadn't come into my head. I was thinking perhaps that there was some kind of theater they were in. He had been in the theater department. He had worked on plays that, you know, he liked to do, take videos, and they were in a video class. So my first thought was this was some kind of a prank where they were acting something out. Something went wrong. I honestly just was terribly confused. And one of my thoughts, of course, was that, well, if there really is a shooting, maybe Dylan's been shot.
Sue Klebold is my guest. Her book, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Her son, Dylan, was one of the shooters at Columbine back in 1999. I should point out that all authors' proceeds from A Mother's Reckoning will go to organizations that prevent mental health and suicide. That's from the proceeds of her book, A Mother's Reckoning. So at what point, Sue, did you hear that Dylan might have been involved?
In the afternoon, when I got home, we were concerned about this diversion issue, because as I said, we were told that if he did anything like put shaving cream on a banister, he could end up with a felony on his record. So we were very concerned about this diversion situation, and if he was in any kind of trouble or showed any kind of poor judgment, it could have a lasting impact on his life. So, you know, my husband had, began trying to figure out what was going on, and he had talked with Mr. Harris, Eric's father. He had contacted an attorney because we thought Dylan might need an attorney. The attorney had contacted the sheriff's department, and ultimately it came back that Dylan was a suspect in whatever was happening at the school, that apparently it was some kind of a shooting and Dylan was somehow involved. And so very early on, we were getting information that this was probably happening. Something was happening, and it was horrible. But we didn't yet understand that people were being killed or hurt, or that Dylan was really responsible for any of that.
At what point did the full force of the situation hit you, Sue, and you understood two things, that people, in fact, were dying at the high school, and secondly, that Dylan was involved?
I think sometime that afternoon, after the SWAT team had come to our house and had prevented us from going in our home, and we were sitting outside, And we could hear the news coming through an open window. And one of the earlier, so much of the reporting, of course, was incorrect because when there's a crisis that's happening, it's very hard to get facts. And we had heard that 25 people were dead. And that's when I really thought, if Dylan is doing this, he's got to stop. Somehow he has to stop. And I do remember at that point praying that he would die, that he would kill himself, because I thought that if he killed himself, then I would know that it had been his wish to die, and that if he'd been shot by the police or something, that I would never know what his last wishes were. So I actually prayed that he would die. So
and you came to regret that prayer, Sue.
I did. In the many years since this tragedy, I have met so many people who have both lost ones to suicide, in some cases murder-suicides, and also family members who have loved ones who were incarcerated. And for those that I've met who have incarcerated family members, there was this twinge of jealousy that I had that, well, at least they could go and see them and talk to them and touch their hands and be with them. And, you know, I had no idea when I uttered that prayer that what suicide was, what it meant, what all the layers of it were involved, and what kind of grief process it would be. I was simply trying to think of some way for him to stop and for me to know that his final wish to die had been his own, and he could make it happen. But it was, for many years, I deeply regretted my wish.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering, Sue, how any human being, much less a boy's mother, can absorb the shock when you learned exactly what his involvement had been in something like this. How did you roll through those moments and keep going?
Well, the actual learning of what happened that day took 6 months. We had gotten bits and pieces of information. There were some witness reports, but so much of the information that was public was incorrect. So I really didn't know what had happened. And for 6 months, I was kind of living in a state of denial. I believed that because Dylan was a good kid, he was, he was a soft-spoken, gentle friend. He was the one that would help somebody on the road if they got a flat tire. You know, this didn't fit who he was to me. And when I really learned what had happened, it was 6 months later when the police report from the incident came out. And I had gone to that private meeting, my husband and I, with the sheriff. And I had a notebook with me, and there were all these questions about...
I'm sorry, what private meeting are you talking about?
The sheriff's department had individual meetings with the victims of the tragedy to go through their report and share with them what they had learned. And we were given the opportunity to go alone and speak with the sheriffs and have them and see their report that they were going to be releasing to the media and show exactly what happened and who had killed whom and where they fell. And it was very detailed. And that was the moment when they were going through this explanation that I really understood that Dylan had willfully participated, that he wasn't there through some mistake, some accident, some kind of coercion, that he had planned it, that he was part of it. And I think that was really kind of my moment of reckoning, where the grief had to rewind and start back to day one. And I really had to think of my son not as someone who was more or less a victim in my mind, but certainly a cruel, terrible, sadistic perpetrator in this. And it was a very difficult time. I don't know how else to describe it. You really have to reinvent. You have to reinvent your love, your relationships, your concept of yourself, your concept of your home, your concept of God, your... All of your belief systems are shaken, and it takes a very long time to restructure those things and get back on your feet again and find a life that has some kind of meaning.
You know, one of the big ideas that emerges from this book is that you now know how little you knew about your son at the time. And that's going to shake parents like myself who you think you know your kids. But I'm wondering, what do you know now about how that can be, Sue?
It's a conundrum because it is a natural and healthy thing for a teenager to try to debond. They will keep secrets. They will keep a secret life. That is part of healthy development. But what we don't know is if they are suffering inside, if they are progressing toward a path of self-destruction or of destruction of others, if they are feeling suicidal, if they are feeling out of balance, how unwilling they are to share that and the lengths that they will go to keep that kind of information hidden, not only from their parents, but really from themselves, because people have a great deal of shame around not feeling like themselves. I think feeling out of balance, feeling that one wants to end one's life, those are symptoms of pathology. And very often people don't understand that. They see themselves as a flawed person, that there's something wrong with them. It's a character deficit. They see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, they are becoming more and more ill. And I think that's what happened. What I believe now, and the thing that I, of all the things that have happened, the thing that I regret the most is that I don't feel that I listened properly. I don't think I ever really sat down to just listen, to listen without judgment, to not try to fix things. I know that when I was growing up and I would feel bad and I'd go to my mother and say, you know, I'm so ugly, nobody likes me. What does a parent say? Oh, I think you're pretty, I love you. We tend to discount their feelings or want to fix things for them. And I'm sure that I did that. And I really wish I had just shut up and listened and tried to validate and understand and access what he was feeling and help him feel, not help him feel better, but just to help him feel. And that is probably my biggest regret.
To what extent, you know, did people try to turn and put the blame on you right away, Sue? Because parents of some of the victims were convinced that you and your husband were hiding something in the days after the tragedy.
Part of this, if we look back, there are guidelines now. They're just brand new guidelines on how to report on mass media. And there are also guidelines, media guidelines, on how to report on suicides so that the community remains safe and healthy and can move on. Those guidelines didn't exist back then. But yes, there was a tremendous amount of blame toward us. Our local leaders they helped fan the flames. I know that our governor went on national television and said that this is the fault of the parents. It caught on very quickly that it was okay to blame the parents, to victimize the families. It sort of became an accepted belief, and I think that happens out of fear. I think people found it impossibly difficult to believe that this could happen to anyone. They felt much safer believing that this had to be the result of defective parenting,
mm-hmm.
Adjustment, and I really believe that people, you know, clung to that because of their own need to feel safe.
You know, you describe you and your husband in the book as, and I'm quoting here, as loving, attentive, and engaged parents. And you also say that Dylan was an enthusiastic, affectionate child. You write this, Sue, the ordinariness of our lives before Columbine will perhaps be the hardest thing for people to understand about my story. And again, that's going to unsettle a lot of parents of older teens particularly, because if that's the case, then you wonder sometimes if any of us are safe.
Well, and I think we are in a time when we must wonder about this. And the chances that someone you love will become violent toward others, will take part in a mass shooting, the chances of that happening are one in millions. It is a very unlikely scenario. What is far more likely is that someone you love may be struggling or suffering, they may be having feelings of suicidality. They may be feeling lost in the thoughts that sort of take over their lives. This is the far more likely scenario. And I have heard that, you know, different statistics from different interpretations, but about 1 in 5, and in some cases 1 in 4, people will have some kind of a mental illness or a period of mental illness in their lives. It is not a rare thing. That is quite common. And we have to find better ways of helping people through these periods, helping them understand that recovery is possible, and get them the help they need before it escalates into something lethal, where someone takes his or her own life or takes the life of someone else.
Sue Klebold was the mother of Dylan Klebold, one of the perpetrators of the Columbine shootings back in 1999. She has a book out, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Looking back on it now, Sue, even with the benefits of hindsight, were there signs that you feel you missed?
I think there probably were. There are signs when someone is struggling. For example, there is a change in behavior. Dylan started to have trouble in his junior year. He got arrested for stealing something. He got in trouble at school. Of course, we came along as parents, you know, kind of a 50s model of, you know, straighten up and fly right. Let's get you back on track here.
Sure.
Those were potential signs. Because these were a change in behavior. Dylan had never gotten in trouble before. There were other signs that were happening that we were not aware of, and that is one of the hallmarks of this Columbine tragedy, is that there were signs, but everyone had a piece of a puzzle and no one put it together. One of his friends knew that he had purchased guns, but we weren't told as parents. Another friend's parents knew that Eric had a website that was dangerous and frightening and obviously very, very created by someone who was seriously disturbed. But we as parents were never told about that website. The mother told the police, but no one told the individuals who were closest to them. So there were all these pieces that were out there that were definitely signs.
But
no one had the big picture. No one put all these together.
You point out that you and your husband didn't own guns. There weren't guns in the house. So how did Dylan and Eric manage to accumulate so many guns?
Well, and I don't think we can say there were so many. We're really just talking. Dylan had purchased 2 guns.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how many Eric had. It was only 1 or 2. They did create homemade bombs, but these bombs didn't kill or hurt anyone. It was the guns that were the things that actually killed people. Dylan bought 2 guns. One was purchased legally, the other was purchased illegally. The one gun was a shotgun, and he did what was a straw purchase. His 18-year-old female friend, Robin, accompanied them to a gun show. They probably shouldn't have been allowed in, but they got in, and she purchased a shotgun because she was 18 years old. And she gave it to Dylan, who was 17 years old. That was a legal transaction, and no laws were broken. And no parental permission was needed, and no parental awareness existed. So that was the purchase of 1 gun. The other gun was a handgun, and he purchased that from someone he had met at work, who knew someone at the gun show. It was kind of a, you know, convoluted thing. But this young man was just selling his firearms. He believed that Dylan was 18 because he had been at the gun show. He never asked Dylan how old he was. He made the assumption Dylan was a graduating senior. He made the assumption he sold Dylan his gun. He believed it was a legal sale, but it turns out Dylan was only 17. This young man ended up getting a 6-year prison sentence for that mistake, and Dylan owned illegally a firearm. So those were how he did that.
You learned something else, and that is this idea that love is not enough to prevent suicide. And I'm wondering, what are you thinking there exactly, Sue?
The individual that I was, the naive person I was before all this happened, I thought we had a happy home. I thought my children were relatively happy. Of course, I knew that they struggled. These are teen years. You know, they have their ups and downs. But I loved my children so much, and I believed that they could talk to me about anything. I told Dylan that he was loved. I threw my arms around him. I hugged him. I believed that those things were protective, that if someone felt deeply loved, they were safe. They would, you know, they would never think of hurting themselves or someone else. And what I have learned is that you can't love away pathology. You can't love away a broken leg. You can't love away cancer. It's in this feeling of connection that is so critical in mental wellness. It has to be the person who is receiving all that love may feel very differently about their experience. I feel in giving that kind of love. So, you know, I want to tell people to not have the same kind of naivete that I did. You know, don't make the assumption that because your children are seem to be healthy and happy and you're loving and you tell them that you love them, that you're doing everything you need to do, because that's not the case. There are too many individuals who die by suicide. They are deeply loved, and those who love them are devastated by their loss.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting idea that you suggest so clearly in the book, that it's a good idea to assume that someone you love may be suffering regardless of how they act. It's important to be proactive almost no matter what you're suggesting.
Yes, I absolutely believe that. And in the years since the tragedy, I have met so many individuals who have lost loved ones to suicide, and I think most of us would agree with that statement.
You know, I want to quote what you have to say at the end of a TED Talk that I listened to last night, and you said this, Sue, again, quoting, "In the end, what I know comes down to this. Even the most vigilant and responsible of us may not be able to help, but for love's sake, we must never stop trying to know the unknowable." So you're suggesting be aware, be vigilant. That's where you want to be.
Yes, and also I think especially now in this climate, in this world where there's, you know, social media and sound bites, I think the ability to just sit and listen and be with somebody, accept their suffering, and know how to respond to that, I think, you know, people lack that skill. It's not that they wouldn't do anything for someone they love. Very often, we just don't know how. One of the things I recommend is that everyone should take a course such as Mental Health First Aid, where we really do learn how to ask someone how they are feeling, how to listen, and listen without any kind of judgment or offering solutions. I think this is critically important because we know that connectivity and feeling involved and close to other individuals is a protective factor that will help keep our loved ones alive and safe.
Yeah.
Help promote mental wellness.
Sue, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story, your openness about this. It's a great set of things for parents to know, and I appreciate the time very much.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's
you
been
bet. Sue Klebold's book, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Tomorrow, conversations about adapting Kansas City and its workers to the current and future economy. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.